Good morning, everybody. I promise that Gilles and me, this will be a pretty informal setting. It's within the family, so to say. I just wanted to say the first time I heard Ranjan speaking was actually on that conference. We had a conference on consciousness and management a few years ago. And I was just very much taken by him relating how he is using the principles of education laid out by the Mother and Sri Aurobindo, even in a formal context in management schools and in different settings and in workshops in different places in India. And I was very much inspired because it felt like that we have such an amazing opportunity within Aurobindo and possibly the freedom to do many things, but often they don't happen. Awesome. And then I met, just a few months ago, I was in Calcutta, and I saw Ranjan's mother had, I think she created and put the foundation for the Sri Aurobindo, is it an ashram?
Institute of Culture.
Institute, educational, a school, catering from creche into plus two, more than 1,000 students. And again, I was very much inspired by the dedication of the work and the strong concentration also, feeling just the ideals which we are striving, so to see them implemented in the middle of very noisy part of Calcutta. And I was very happy Ranjan said he would come for a visit to Pondicherry. His family and I said we have a forum, an open forum here in University of Human Unity, and I did ask him if he would be willing to share something of his experience in education.
That's absolutely right. First of all, my deep gratitude to Aurelio and all of you, the fact that there's an opportunity for us to meet, interact and talk. I did say to Aurelio, of course, when he was there and when he said that, could I come and share something? And very often when we use the word share, we use it very loosely. Because what is intended somewhere, because of the fact that we are all very fond of structure normally, that it starts, as he also told me later on, starts with a very formal, or not a formal, but at least a presentation by the resource person, and then, you know, inputs around it. But what I had intended was a much more free sharing, which means the sharing of thoughts and ideas. And the reason why I was looking for the whiteboard is that, and this white paper will do as well, is to just have a kind of really a sharing session, not really a talk followed by, questions and answers and stuff like that. Because that format presupposes that the person who's speaking knows more than the people who are listening, which is not necessarily true by any stretch of imagination, particularly in this kind of a thing. Well, of course, some of you, as Rod was just saying, I mean, you've been there when I was there in the town hall that time. There has been a subsequent occasion when I came and I think I spoke to the Oroville Business Council. That was a year later, and I guess, I think that must have been last year I did not come, except for a visit to Matri Mandir and, of course, this opportunity. Let me say that just before we start on that formal session, or not formal, the very informal sharing session, I think I just need to add a few things, because he asked me, Aurelio said, what would you like to speak on, and then, or rather share your experiences on, and then he asked for a bio sketch, which is what I did send. And then I think I discovered fairly recently that the topic you had all chosen would be education, educational excellence,
yeah.
Right? Let me just talk about educational excellence and where I think Aurelio must have picked it up from. He did pick it up from my bio.
I think I picked it up.
You picked it up? Okay, Rod picked it up, fine.
And I chose that title deliberately.
Yeah, okay, but I don't know whether you did notice in my bio there's a mention of that phrase, educational excellence. Because in the Indian Institute of Management, which is one of India's leading management schools, it's probably within number one or to number three, I mean, depending on who's giving the rankings. We've been conducting a very successful program on educational excellence for the last 2 years now. And some of India's most known educationists, principals, secretaries, of all forms, I mean, they've come of all boards also. That means that includes the International Baccalaureate, that includes the IGCSE, both London and Cambridge, that includes the CISC format, the Council for Indian School Certificate Examinations, that includes the Central Board of Secondary Education, and some even from the state boards. So we've just had two rounds of that for schools and two rounds of that for colleges. In the case of colleges and universities, we were very lucky to even get people from the University Grants Commission, as well as education secretaries of different states of India. So, you know, a very wide spectrum of people, also people with an extremely broad range of interests. So we've just completed 2 years of that very successfully, so much so that just after the first round, the Central Board of Secondary Education approached the Indian Institute of Management to conduct a tailor-made program only for them. And we had to do two programs in the summer of this year, in May actually, just for CBSE schools. So that's just one kind of introduction. We've also replicated that for the TVS, you know, the bikes. I think you must be knowing, because Auroville has plenty of these two-wheelers. TVS has a group of schools in Madurai. And last year, around Christmas, we had come to talk to the TVS groups of schools in Madurai. So typically, we are doing this on a 2.5 to 5 day format, right? So, and it includes many subjects like the psychology of the child. Of course, you start with that. Then you go on and, you know, look at, for instance, the pedagogical methods that you could perhaps use. And then we look at various styles of education, various styles of offering education. We look at different, for instance, measurements. How do you assess performance evaluation, both of students as well as teachers? We look at also other aspects like how does education connect to human values? How do you infuse patriotism in school education? How do you infuse, for instance, the concept of unending learning, as you know, within the, you know, embed that into the process of education? So it's a very long process, of course. Now, so just to describe to you what we've been doing in that format. On the other format, let me say that, as Aurelio just told you, I've been having the good fortune of running a school called the Future Foundation School now for almost 10 years, which my mother basically pivoted. It was a school that was started with the mother's blessings as a kindergarten in 1972. And it then went further. In 1984, it became a high school called the Future Foundation School, and which my mother ran very successfully, and I took over only in 1999, more by accident than by anything else. And I've had the good fortune of actually working there. So whatever, you know, that I've been sharing in the Indian Institute of Management is not so much of bookish learning, it's more of what one has been facing on a day-to-day basis, working with children, working with teachers. And for the last 8 years, I've been a board member of the Council for Indian School Certificate Examinations in New Delhi. So that's about it, you know. That gives another kind of perspective into the challenges and problems facing school educators in India. So, just that. And of course, through IIM, since it's an institute of management, I do teach even postgraduate students also familiar with that kind of a system. Occasionally, we do interact with educators from elsewhere in the world and listen to what they are going through and stuff. Okay, so that's, so you know exactly what kind of thing I'm coming from. What I thought of how to approach this session, rather than, you know, telling you anything on my own, I thought that I would take down a few thoughts that you might have. Comments, questions, what you feel you're having either problems with, or what you feel you'd like to share on a broader format. Anything. You know, and I just make a note of that. And we, you know, together evolve something out of it. If that's acceptable. Yeah, so anything. I mean, please feel free to. It can be a comment, it can be a question, it can be something, but which we will all discuss together.
Yeah, I would like to ask something which I'm especially interested in as a Western person. You were talking about the concept of never-ending learning.
Yes.
The concept of Orwell. I would be interested to know how in the general India, let's say, if you can say so, this idea is picked up, or how it is understood, and how people react on it.
Okay. All right. That you mean that not necessarily only in schools, but in general?
Yeah, but also in schools, because yes. We have this development of looking for always better degrees and this and that. And
true.
Is there in the mind also something more than that?
Yes, okay.
I would be interested to know, according to your experience, what in a future creation of education, according to mother's view, what is the place of the mentor, and how, what is the balance that you can do? If, and just to give you a certain perspective, we are in the University of Humanity presently working on a project to make out of Oroville a learning place and to launch a student program for Westerners. And the question is, should it be an experienced geared to life, how to live 6 months, for instance, in Oroville, and share the life of the Orovillians and discover its all research and perspective and discoveries. And one of my questions is how much we should have intellectual input in this process of transformation, and how to make it really effective and true to mother's view.
Well, I have one question all the time. It's about the integral paradigm of learning. And what would you say about it? How it is viewed, how it is approached? Is it at all looked into? Is there such concept altogether? I'm not sure that it is even emerging somewhere in full sense. And if it is, what would you be? What kind of approaches to this integral paradigm of learning are available? Is there some research?
Approaches outside Pondicherry, outside Oroville. But when you say integral paradigm of learning, I imagine you're talking more about what we call integral education, right? In yeah? Okay. Yes.
I'm more interested in the question that there was this saying the 21st century will be spiritual or will not be. But when we look to our educational systems, we have very little importance to spiritual education of the children, and even in India it has somehow been reduced in favor of other technical and other parts. And my question to you would be, how can we come back to it, and how can we define the quality of this spiritual learning.
Okay.
I'm a teacher and I'm immersed in education every day. So at the moment I don't have questions.
Okay.
I'm just going to listen to what discussion transpires.
All right.
I have recently affiliated a school where I am the principal with the CBSE.
Okay.
And I have done that in Oracle context for two or three reasons that I feel are quite valid. One is that the NCERT, the new NCERT syllabus, I find to be quite good. Both in terms of content and in terms of learning theory.
Mm.
The constructivist approach, I think, is the correct approach.
Mm-hmm.
But then the problem that India faces, it's a contextual problem, which we also face, is how to unlock teacher potential so that activity-based learning can really be implemented.
Mm-hmm.
And in our local area, village, considering village children, and most of the educational problem in India is considering village children, they're very limited in their conceptual exposure.
Yes.
And so this approach to learning can be extremely beneficial, but it's, again, dependent upon teacher ability and knowledge and experience also.
Yes.
I spoke with Gupta, Dr. Gupta, about doing some teacher training.
Mm-hmm.
At about the same time that you were providing some CBSE training. Because the teachers in the schools around here, the principals of schools around here, see that we have an environment which is a bit out of the ordinary box in which teachers can be stimulated fairly easily.
Yes.
To get new ideas and to see what it means to do activity-based learning. And so Oroville has a potential right now, we're not doing this at all yet, but we have a potential to create teacher training programs that can be very useful in general educational context.
Yes.
Organize that and implement it is something that we might be able to look at more in detail on a long-term schedule of some kind.
Okay.
That would be
one question. That's okay. Very interesting points, actually, yes.
Well, I think my question is asked.
All right.
I don't know how much I should add because I have already enough material.
Okay.
But what I'm interested personally is, and maybe it's even a personal question, how you manage in a secular context like Management Institute to imbibe and to bring forward our integral ideas. Because I know you're going also for workshops in Bangalore with aeronautical institutes at very professional levels, and I'm just interested in that experience of yours in this high caliber professional world, how you can bring your devotion, because I know that part of you, how that you manage without being in two worlds.
Okay, all right.
I also feel that perhaps there's enough material on all the right. table already.
Okay.
I'm wondering if we should add more.
And I guess more of comments and observations than questions.
Yeah, tell me.
Just in terms of my background, as I come from urban India, from the education of privileged people, my brothers and friends go to IITs and Athens. And I'm currently working for a study abroad program based in Oroville.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very much experiential education, self-directed education, extensive one-to-one mentoring, all the things that I value, and not just teaching about education.
questions and concerns are in that sort of high input, one-to-one, self-directed learning. It takes so much time, and there is a sense that an impending environmental and social crisis, there is just not enough time.
Mm-hmm.
So much time to do all the change. And the second question is, actually it was with my brother recently in Bombay, where he teaches at the IIT, and he was just so sad because he doesn't see that IIT is doing anything innovative in education. There's neither interest among the faculty nor among the students. It all comes to a matter of getting a degree and getting a job. So I was curious about your
institutions. Okay.
I have a question. When I was a university student, the university they give freedom for you to choose your subject. But even the student themselves, they can't they don't know what they are interested in, and sometimes they have the freedom, but they don't have the opportunity to choose.
To help children choose, you mean? That's to help students choose in university what they would like to study. Is that what you...
Mm-hmm.
To help a student decide what he would like to study. Is that what you...
Yes. I think it's very difficult because even the people themselves, they can't understand how can a teacher give them an advice. Because someone asked me what subject I choose, I can't give the answer.
Okay. All right. Okay. Sir.
I've been very interested in the functioning of the brain for the last year.
Mm-hmm.
And I think my question is also has to do with other questions. Is it about making a better brain, or is it, which is already a lot of work, I think, you know, or is it about using the brain as a tool for higher consciousness? You know?
Mm-hmm.
I think there's quite a lot to say about this.
Okay, that's a huge topic in itself.
Maybe it's more a personal question. India, how is the education of art? How is the education of art? It has a very fantastic system in the background, teaching Guru Shishya. But how this system has place in the modern education, which I think it's more on the intellectual side than on the side which is also spiritual.
But you specifically want to think about art, educating.
Especially music.
Yes, okay. Art, all right, including music, yes. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, I feel there's enough.
All right, okay. Well, there's a lot on the plate, and I have to decide where to start from. Let me, you know, not necessarily go in the order that perhaps has been put out on the table. Let me start with something which you've mentioned here, Rod, right? The activity-based learning in the context of village children and the kind of program that Oroville perhaps could develop in future to address that kind of need. I can share with you something which is very unique that's happening in the state of West Bengal in the same context. I don't know whether you've heard of a village called Ushagram. Anybody here? No. Ushagram literally means the village of the dawn. In a sense, it is very similar, therefore, the inspiration for the name is very similar to the name of Auroville itself, right? The gentleman who founded Ushagram is located about 40 kilometers or 50 kilometers from Calcutta in the middle of a cluster of villages, right? The nearest town is called Ranaghat, the district is Nodia, just to, in case anybody would be interested to figure out more. The gentleman who founded it was some kind of a person who was inspired by Mahatma Gandhi and therefore had village development as his mission in life. Did not marry, a gentleman by the name of Gopal Babu, just expired a few months ago in his 80s. Ushagram serves a cluster of 18 villages. It's in a place called Birnagar, serves 18 villages. I can say that it's a very innovative experiment as far as village education is concerned. Let me share with you one thing I've seen, which is probably very rare. In Ushagram, they have a lot of stuff that you have in Auroville. I wouldn't say like that, but on a very, very small scale. They do a lot of work on, for instance, on solar energy. They do a lot of work with jute, which is, you know, part of the Bengal tradition. They do a lot of stuff with textiles. They do, with renewable energy. There's a lot of work that's happening there. And they get some funding from various foreign sources as well as some government and Indian sources. So it's a very different place, and it also has Sri Aurobindo's relics for the last, I think, 5 or 6 years. It's actually a Sri Aurobindo center. We send our children for an excursion every year to Ushagram. Actually, we send children for excursions from our school to various other schools, and Ushagram, they go, is the first excursion they go to because it's the closest geographically to us. And when they grow up, well, I don't want to get into that unless that comes up in a different context. Let me tell you the way they teach geography. They basically have a sundial, they have an observatory, and they basically start by looking at the place where the child is coming. So the first learning of geography is in the compound where the study of geography is taking place. Then it extends and covers the whole village. Where is the post office? Where is the local bank, if there is one? Where are the various little things there? Where is the river? You know, taking them on expeditions. Then, since they serve a cluster of 18 villages, then the geography or the topography of all of this, right? So basically, and this is very unique because it doesn't happen elsewhere in India. Perhaps it's an idea that's very native to Auroville, but it's not native to the rest of this country. What I'm trying to say is that the study of geography doesn't start from the textbook. It starts with something that's absolutely experiential, that the child can see, can feel, can relate to. Right? And everything is taught in the same manner. So it would not, the medium of instruction, of course, would then be Bengali, the local Bengali. It would all proceed from that one fundamental point. Now, of course, all these ideas are not strange, but what I'm trying to suggest is that perhaps when you are thinking of a teacher training scheme that is based on the ideals of the Mother and Sri Aurobindo, and you're looking at village development, perhaps you could look at the Ushagram experiment in a little greater detail. As I said, that's one. They also have, which in the CBSE system is not unknown, they have what they call Bal Nilayas, or not Bal Nilayas, Bal Vidyalayas, whatever. And that is all sponsored by it's all within the CBSE system. So village development is happening at the core. That's the experimental school, shall we say. Then the learnings of that experimental school are being disseminated in a slightly formal context within the CBSE environment of learning. And they've been doing this successfully now for many, many years and working exclusively with village children. There's no urban child who goes there. But it's a homogeneous environment that you get there, perhaps in Oroville. It would not be entirely homogeneous because it's not only Tamilians you're catering to. But as far as village development is concerned, Ushagram has done a unique kind of work, which, since you said that you're looking at CBSE, you're looking at village development, looking at Ushagram, or perhaps, you know, going and spending, they have very good lodging facilities because we send about 50 odd children there. Yes?
The reason why I find the syllabus interesting,
yes,
is because it incorporates ideas like that.
Yes.
And I designed a curriculum 20 years ago for a school in America, which I ran, which is based on geography.
Absolutely.
So I'm very familiar with,
yes,
how to give an orientation,
yes,
to activity-based learning to concepts like geography. And it's here, it's possible to do that, you know, quite easily.
Yes.
In a more structured educational environment, it's not so easy.
That's true.
You know, if you're in a special environment, that can be done very easily. Then the principle is articulated, including the environment, including the society, including the values,
yes,
of the society, is highly recommended in the syllabus.
Yes.
But teachers haven't learned like that. They have learned to repeat the facts.
Yes.
To enable students to, yes, repeat facts means learning. And the higher up the ladder you go, the more entrenched that system becomes, so that actually it gets cut off completely from learning.
True.
And it just becomes a matter of repetition. So this is a big problem, an interesting problem for educational development, especially if we want to achieve some kind of universal quality education in India. To take that concept, which is very easy to implement at the primary level, and implement it at the secondary level in a meaningful way. You know, that seems to me to be where the crux of the problem is.
Okay, then let's graduate perhaps to the next level of that question. I did mention Ushagram because it was the CBSE context, you know, then you mentioned the CBSE affiliation. So they are working in a very, very Indian and a rural context. So that's why I thought of giving you that example, and they're doing it successfully for so many years. What you say is very correct, that in the primary level, this is easier to translate into, you know, doing it. But I think even in secondary level, it's quite, it can be done. And we do a bit of it in our school. I don't say that we have perfected it. I don't think, this is an unending journey, like in any other area. When if you talk of spirituality, there's no frontier that you keep on overcoming. What we have tried to do at the secondary level is to build around a certain number of different things which are perhaps not entirely possible in the primary. One is the fact that we do, for instance, we've done for quite a few years now, teaching physics and, for instance, other science subjects through seminars. Seminars where children write their own paper, that, you know, and they present it to the rest of the class. Now, seminars cannot be entirely evolved at the primary level, simply because of, you know, the maturity of children and skills level. But at the secondary level, we found that seminars can be an extremely useful tool to further that. That's one area we found that to be very interesting to work with. The other very interesting area that we found is exhibitions. It lends itself very easily to science, but increasingly what we've tried to use exhibitions for is to explore interdisciplinary learning. One of the big challenges, as we all realize, is that most of our knowledge is compartmentalized. The way the curriculum anywhere proceeds is, well, this is physics, so, you know, this is physics. This is chemistry, so this is chemistry. The moment you work on an exhibition or on a theme or a project or a number of projects, you can make even secondary children realize that there are frontiers which are not encompassed only in that one field. So we explore the boundaries between economics and sciences, between, let's say, the mathematics and biology, between information and something else. So, you know, all these kinds of things we found that integrate very easily. Part of the learning from that helps in understanding also that learning, therefore, is necessarily experiential. It works in two ways. One is, of course, the exhibition idea itself leads to the fact that children are evolving a bit on their own without overt and continuous guidance from the teacher and to some extent removed from the teaching of the curriculum. But it also helps in several other ways because it teaches teachers, for instance, or helps teachers understand that the way we all learned in school is not necessarily the only way. So it helps bridge that kind of thing. In terms of, let's say, how does one break the resistance of teachers on a more formal sense? I've observed the following, that the first year that teachers tried to do something, there was a huge resistance. It had to be pushed. There were only very, very few teachers who seemed to be receptive to the new ideas. They said, oh, this cannot be done. And even when they said it can be done, they seemed to fall back on certain old, on old notions and old paradigms. And then they said, oh, but it cannot be done otherwise. At the end of the first year, they began to see that there perhaps could be one other way of looking at things. In the second year, they realized that, yes, it's possible. And the third year, they themselves were doing it. So there were smiles on everybody's faces at the end of it. So somewhere, the issue with teacher education is this, that one just has to persist, perhaps. And over a period of time, it just shows. And for some, of course, who are very lucky, they know it from day one. But that seems to be some, very often, a minuscule minority. So I don't know whether this partly answers whatever we were talking about. Yes. Yes.
By this couple of $1 million. It was like the cleanest villages I've ever been, and as you said, the children had drawn maps of the villages. They had assessed the village in terms of hygiene, so their parents and their uncles would come and see where the children were sitting. Oh, this is not clean. And the best thing was when we walked into the room and there were a number of us, none of the children even looked up. You know, foreigners, strangers coming to a classroom. And they're all busy with their little activities. None of them have turned it off. And they do a teacher training program and taking a group of village teachers from here. So that could be something good.
Yeah. Let me take another extreme end of the spectrum then. We come back to this because, you know, although we think these are all dissected things, ultimately it's all part of that circle called education. I think let's talk of, you know, what we call spiritual education. That question came up, I think, from you, sir. Spiritual education and how does one do it in Auroville? Of course, you know that much better than I do. But how could that be done in India? And I think that, you know, that also would connect a bit to Aurelio's question on how does one take these ideas and teach it in a secular setting, as you very nicely put it. First of all, I think that spiritual education, when we use that phrase, we begin to think somewhere that spirituality is either divorced from life or spirituality is something other than what we are doing. But if we approach it in a very, in one sense, that, you know, there's this famous saying of Sri Aurobindo, which we are all aware of, all life is yoga. I mean, spirituality, if it is to be the pivot and the basis of everything that we do, in a sense is a very Catholic thing. It is very all-embracing in its widest sense, and I think one has to start with that kind of a basis. What I found at the school level that kind of works is that we allow a kind of question-answer-unraveling kind of a concept. That means children are free to ask, and children are free to get their answers. If they don't, they keep on asking. So that's one thing. If you ask me, how does one then teach Mother and Sri Aurobindo? We have approached that through exhibitions again. Fundamentally, there everyone works on at least two exhibitions in the year. And I'm only talking of the spirituality aspect now. Not, there's the part that connects with science, so that's one. But the other part of it is that we do an exhibition every year by school children on Sri Aurobindo's birthday, another one on Mother's birthday. And every year we choose a different aspect. I mean, it could be something as simple as, or as complicated as, the mother and nature. And it allows children to realize that, you know, building a relationship with nature is actually very akin to, if not part of, spirituality. One does not have to articulate the fact that, listen, this is part of spirituality. But the moment they relate what Mother is saying with nature, they get to understand. So it's topics like that which we keep exploring every year with the children. That is with children. With teachers, what we've done somewhat successfully is to run a kind of study circle, which means now I'm talking of teachers who are already evolved. I'm not talking of people who have just, you know, breaking their initial barriers on this kind of education. But what we've tried to do is, after we've come to a platform where more or less are on the same ground and there's no dispute that this is the kind of education we should be doing, then the teacher-taught relationship is even more fuzzy. And therefore every teacher is therefore a kind of an instructor to every other teacher. So we have exactly what we are doing today, a sharing thing, except that it's done in the following way. We would choose, for instance, there's this very thin book of Sri Aurobindo called A System of National Education. It's actually part of the bigger book, but it's a very simple and small booklet. We would take a part of a chapter once a week, and then we would all read it together. And then we would ask every teacher, or rather not every teacher, we would divide all our teachers into groups. And we would ask them, listen, how do you translate these ideas of Sri Aurobindo into the classroom? And what happens is that each teacher and or group of teachers come up with ideas. And sometimes we find that ideas that come from secondary section teachers can be utilized in the primary and vice versa. Even nursery and kindergarten teachers sometimes come up with, you know, ideas that you can scale up to very different things, or you can have extrapolation leading to very different results. And we found that does wonders. So, two things. So, if you ask for spiritual education, and we've taken our spiritual guides and mentors, if you will, as Mother and Sri Aurobindo, then at the children's level and at the teacher level, this is how we go about it. Other than that, it's like a curriculum that evolves simply from questions and answers. Children ask, and a group of teachers endeavor to answer. If they don't, children try to find out for themselves. And that's how it carries on. There is sometimes a book which children are encouraged to read if they feel like reading it. But it is not made mandatory. The last bit that we do is with parents, because that's perhaps, one shouldn't lose sight of that perspective. That's a very important perspective. And since we are located in Calcutta and children go back and report whatever happens on a day-to-day basis, the first thing that we do when we admit children to our school is that we don't really conduct a test for them, but we conduct a test for the parents. We ask parents to write down, or we give them a set of questions which basically try to assess their philosophy of bringing up their own child. Right? A set of questions. And we look at the answers not with a view to saying whether the parents are right or wrong. We get about typically six, we administer it to both mother and father. We make them sit separately and write the answers. Right? So two things come out of it. One is that, for instance, we typically get about 600 odd applications for a seat strength that is only 70. And the children are 3 years old when they come into our school. So we get 600, so we administer it to 1,200 people. 1,200 men, 600 fathers and 600 mothers. So the first thing we see is whether mother and father are aligned. Because we do the pairing after the taking back the answer script. So we study whether they have paired well. So whether they think similarly when it comes to their children. Now that's, many people would think that they do it, but they actually might not. The children are only 3 years old, so they know simple answers. They've coached themselves into thinking, oh well, you know, if I go to this school, then this is what will happen. But the notions are usually at the superficial level. So it allows us, first of all, to check that within themselves, fathers and mothers are aligned on what the way they would bring up their children. The next thing that we do is that we check whether that alignment matches with the alignment of the school itself. Because instead of saying what the mother said, well, we do offer a certain certification. But the philosophy is different. We don't necessarily teach children to get high marks. It's another matter that coincidentally they do get high marks. But we want to check it out that the parents' orientation and the school's orientation are in alignment. And when people come and ask, we have the simple answer to give them, that listen, we don't say you are right or we are right. We just want to see that everybody is in alignment. So then we shortlist and we get a certain group of parents, which is about 200 odd, 200, sometimes between 200 and 250. Then we ask them to come for a face-to-face discussion, which is more in the way of a discussion. Out of that, 70 children are finally shortlisted. So it's more a merit, if you will, of the parents, but we do at the interview stage, do take a look at the child. We don't take a look at the child in terms of asking him too many things. We have a child's corner, where the child comes, plays, we see how he or she is moving around, the facial expressions, the happiness on the face. And many a time when, for instance, the parents don't get along very well at home, it shows on the child, the stress shows on the child. So these are the kinds of things which is not always possible to get in the questionnaire session. So we understand that at that level. Plus, if there are any other issues which are sorted out on a face-to-face basis. So that is the kind of alignment that happens there. So on a broad level, this is what we do in terms of, shall we say, spiritual education. We also ask them occasionally, in the whole of the education, because they all are part of one club or another. And when they grow up, and I'm talking of, you know, as adults, they're part of a social service club which is allied to the Rotary International, or they work with an environment club which is Nature Club. We were the first school in Calcutta to implement a rainwater harvesting with groundwater recharge. They do vermicompost and all kinds of things they do, Save the Tiger project, many a thing they've done. And paper recycling, and you know, not only that, they do go and do campaigning elsewhere. They adopt slums, they adopt villages, all kinds of things. In every one of this, we make sure that the learning encompasses a certain spiritual element, which is not overtly stated. That means we don't say, listen, this is spiritual. So that seeps in, it is like an undercurrent. If you will, we've had the blessing which you have in Auroville. We have Sri Aurobindo's relics there in our campus. We feel that that's the main shrine. We find, and Aurelio, you must have seen it during your stay, many children voluntarily go and spend time there during their breaks in class or just in the morning. Sometimes before exams, they'll sit and read a little bit from their books, you know, and that continues till the time they leave school. For their school leaving exam, we make them come and, you know, play mother's music, and they sit down for meditation, take a blessing, and, you know, the blessings that come, and then they go. So it's something that, if you know, we take advantage of that environment. So we don't necessarily have to say that, listen, this is what spirituality is. Okay. Other than that, we do discuss. Now comes the other part. This is the easy part of what we do. The other part is now, how do we tell them what is not to be done? Now that again comes as a discussion element. You know, we take up issues that affect society and we have discussions. Interestingly, you see, there are many schools which conduct these classes. They call them usually moral instruction. Right from the inception of our school, we didn't like that name. So we've taken a name, we've actually copied a name from Sri Aurobindo himself. We call these classes Ideals and Progress. So it's just a straightforward plagiarism, if you will, from Sri Aurobindo. But we've at least not, you know, written a book out of it. We've plagiarized it for the benefit of the children. It gives the idea to the children that ideals are not just static, they are dynamic. And, you know, face to face, we discuss problems, we discuss issues, there are various things. There's another thing I think which is important to mention when we talk of spiritual education, although it's not necessarily related only to spirituality. We've observed that one of the big issues that we have with our children, and I think that's common to a lot of schools in any setting in the country today, is the fact that parents and children don't think and feel alike on a variety of things. Secondly, there's a lot of psychological stress building that happens because of two things. Parents going to work, children living with maids or with very old grandparents, stuff like that. It's one kind of issue. Adolescence issues which parents do not necessarily appreciate. We found that children need to be able to vent that, you know, release that somewhere, to discuss their problems. And we found in our case that because of the fact that perhaps we take care of 1,000 children, and although we have, by outside notions, a favorable teacher-student ratio, we have 80 teachers to take care of 1,000 children, but still that is way below what is actually required. So we take advantage of a modern notion of a counselor. People who are basically trained to be psychoanalysts. But all that they do is, there's a distinction, as you all know, between psychoanalysts and psychiatrists. So these are not people who come with any medication in mind, but they just sit and talk it out with children. And children are allowed, we have two counselors who come alternate days, and so therefore children are free to choose the counselor they would like to go and talk to. And very often we, although the counselor doesn't, you know, keeps much of this as, you know, as part of their professional ethics, keeps a lot of this within themselves, But we come to know of certain issues in our school, maybe by some teachers who are not being sensitive, perhaps, or of new kinds of issues that are coming up. And with that we help, you know, that kind of is helped in the point.
May I add a question which I have experienced in the Arab country?
Please, please.
I used to be a counselor for 30 years in Europe. And since I'm working with village people here in Auroville,
yes.
I felt always that the most difficult thing is that we have a other value system around the people, which is impregnated by capitalistic ideas or by economic ideas or a lot of other ideas which are far away from spirituality. And to interest young people, let's say between, I'm working mostly between 16 and 30, for this other type of value systems, seems very difficult to me, even in an Arabic context where they have a lot of opportunities, even children who have done 10 years or 12 years in Arabic schools easily go for earning a lot of money, having a good career, and losing all these aspects.
Okay, let me then, because then we're talking of a different age group, right? Yeah. We were talking all this while about school, so we'll shift it to what you talk about, the Management Institute. Let me say there that the first thing when we talk of students, the Indian Institute of Management, to just give you in a nutshell one idea, teaches students, right? That's our primary job. We have two kinds of programs, primarily. Let me just list that. First of all, we have the two-year MBA program. We call it the PGP because the Indian Institutes of Management are not statutorily universities. So we give a postgraduate diploma, which is recognized across the world. Which is 2 years, and it's been running now for 45, 46 years, started in 1961. We've started an executive MBA about a year and a half ago, which is for people with 7 to 10 years experience, so therefore older. We also now run a number of programs which are partly on video conferencing mode and partly on contact mode, so they come and go. In all these programs, and there are many in the last category, and the last program we're now doing is for manufacturing managers in collaboration with two IITs. We call the program Visionary Leadership in Manufacturing. IIT Chennai and IIT Kanpur have collaborated with IIM Calcutta to administer this last one. All these programs now have business ethics as a core part of the curriculum. You know, it's something that they all have to go through. So that's the, you know, in the, and of course we also do a number of programs on request from either organizations. He mentioned Hindustan Aeronautics, but it comes from all kinds of organizations. When I go back, Power Grid Corporation, they are coming up with their newsletter. They've invited me many times. They want an article on ethics and so forth. I just recently ran a series of programs myself for the Airports Authority of India. So it's public sector, private sector, almost everybody wants it. Now, I'll come back to that element a little later, but I think your question is specific to students. In the second year, and I think I'll take that example, in the second year of these two-year postgraduate program, we have courses that are called the following. We have one course which I take, Ethics in International Business. Then together with another faculty member, I share sessions on corporate social responsibility. Then we have Management through Human Values. And we have Management of NGOs. All right, the last one, of course, is not entirely spiritual, but also it has a certain spiritual thing. In the Management by Human Values course, we are now, this year, we have 58 students, which is very, very high. These are all people who are going to go out into the world and perhaps be employed by organizations like the now defunct Goldman Sachs, of course, but or almost defunct Goldman Sachs and people like that in huge amounts in salaries. What we found is that this is a choice they are making. out of 20 electives, they choose 4 or 5, right? And we have an overwhelming response. We're finding it difficult to cater to so many courses in the second year because we have only 3 terms. And in every term, we are finding 2 subjects being taken by a total of maybe half the entire promotion or half the entire class, which is a huge, huge number. So what I can tell you from experience is that perhaps if you take care of their material aspirations, and I know I'm saying something which is conjecture, I don't have an exact answer. If you taken care of their material aspirations, it means now they're assured by the time they've completed a year in the Indian Institute of Management, they're all fairly assured that by the time they get in, they're assured. By the time they've finished 1 year, they know they'll get good jobs. Then the attention is shifting to social and ethical issues. It's very, very clear, just from the student response. However, if we expect it, for instance, that they will ignore their material aspirations to shift to a spiritual bent of mind, I think that's asking too much. Let's face it. Exclusive, you know, and I think, let me refer in a bit of a tongue-in-cheek manner, let me refer to my first reading of The Life Divine. If you recall, the first few chapters, and I'm not going to enter into a philosophical discourse, you know, we don't need to be getting into that. The first chapter, if you remember, is called The Human Aspiration, right? The second chapter is The Materialist Denial, right? And the third chapter is The Refusal of the Ascetic, if you remember. And there's a fourth chapter which then unites both these different paradigms. So what Sri Aurobindo is trying to say there is that the materialist denial he's almost virtually equating with the refusal of the ascetic. He has nowhere suggested that one is necessarily superior to the other. In fact, he synthesizes chapter 2 and chapter 3 into chapter 4 and contextualizes spirituality in the here and now. So once we do that and we take care of that wholesome thing, then it's taken care of. In fact, if we talk of India, you will all know that Sri Aurobindo has made it pointedly mentioned that one of the reasons for our material decline and material prosperity was because after attaining a lot of prosperity in India, at some stage, we thought that it was important to be otherworldly. And hence, that is the point at which the decline in our material prosperity in this civilization started. Before that, materialism and spirituality coexisted. Perhaps materialism was subsumed in spirituality, and the best of scientific achievements, cultural achievements, and the pursuit of wealth happened simultaneously, except that Indian civilization never glorified the acquisition of wealth as an exclusive purpose, right? But even if you now go to the Buddha, and many people have the notion that, you know, it is that Buddhistic notion and the Shankara notion that led to the material decline. Even there, if you just read the story of the Buddha and you contextualize it in fasting, you remember there was a time when the Buddha was fasting, hoping for enlightenment. And finally he became just bones and he realized this is not the way. So even there, they're talking of the middle path. So when we educate our children, in whichever, you know, context, we need to remember that we have to open their doors and offer them the freedom of choice. Show them the entire spectrum and allow their swabhava or their swadharma, what they innately are, to express, and they will, you know, go on that track. And perhaps in a way that we don't imagine or we cannot relate to. You know, that would be perhaps a kind of response that
this
I've...
This progression which Sri Aurobindo mentioned, so I'm trying to remember the first term. It starts with kama, dharma.
Dharma, artha, kama, moksha.
Artha comes first, no?
No, the four, it's part of the quartet.
Yes, the quartet.
Quartet, one is dharma.
Yes.
One is dharma, artha, mm-hmm. Kama and Moksha.
So, this feeling that we start from the need to establish our material existence,
mm-hmm.
this comes first, and it's so important in our
absolutely.
Present context here, you know, and I think Mother also emphasized it. You know.
But it is the physical. We have to first put the material foundation.
And then comes the concern with living according to dharma and through your material life expressing some kind of inner truth or social truth
yes.
place in society. And only beyond that come the higher stages of moksha and so on. So, we shouldn't forget that when we are dealing with children and try to set
absolutely.
The target too high, it, actually I think what you are suggesting is that they should be allowed to set the targets themselves.
Yes, and then you, if you allow that,
mm-hmm.
in all Catholicity and conviction, you will find that they will come round on their own.
It's naturally the atmosphere.
Yes. But if we consciously make this division, this is spiritual, this is not spiritual, this is overtly materialistic, we are perhaps doing a disservice to them and to us. It's,
we could also have tea. Because
yes, sure, sure. Can we just finish two
yes.
minutes perhaps with yeah, round off on what we were doing? I think I just one point I wanted to make. Now I've lost track. Maybe I'll remember later.
I also had a comment about the fact that when the mother established the ashram as a community, she said that providing the material, physical needs of everybody would perhaps free them to focus.
That's what she calls a dream, that particular.
Well,
yeah.
That is, I mean, she didn't provide luxuries, but. When the basics are there, then you have time and energy to think about something beyond. But if you're in a situation where you're struggling to provide a roof over your head or food, you cannot focus your energies on
that. Vivekananda said that very...
But in her reading also,
yes.
she's implying that members of society
that's true.
The arts, they should be able to give fully to the well-being of the society.
True.
She's assuming a community of people who are competent on all levels of existence.
True.
You know, it's the purpose of that that holistic vision is to create an evolutionary humanity, and that includes
that's
every
true.
Level of existence. So when, I like the idea that in schools, by enabling or empowering students to grapple with socioeconomic problems and to love the biology of nature, is itself an opening into a spiritual
absolutely.
Perception
yeah.
of existence. I mean, art and science and poetry and politics are driven by spirit.
Yes.
So it's the infusion of a genuine love of learning and progressing, I think, which is the key to spirituality in education. It's not separate from education.
No, no,
at all.
No.
There is one point small. All this is all right, provided that the teachers have completely different orientation. If you are doing that and you are really supporting their well-being and welfare, it is absolutely different than somebody else who has no idea about that, what you are doing that. And there will be a difference, and that difference has to be seen. If we are spiritually inclined and seeking for a higher meaning in life, doing that
yes.
is one thing. And if it is done in an ordinary manner, it is done in the world, in the same thing, it would have completely different.
I think that's a very interesting point you bring up there. But maybe we should have tea, might be getting cold, right?
I want to say something that is, according sources, ethics is so into the time, it goes small because there's no principle behind, no spirituality, nowhere to go. I see that it's so small, and I ask myself, when we see a decline of the material, when people rush into the search of something they don't know what is.
I think I'll just, I think yours is a much deeper point, but I'll just quickly answer your question. See, we at this school, the school that we run in Calcutta, one must understand, in a sense, it is a school like any other. We employ, we pay our teachers, and, you know, we recruit them on the basis of their avowed or, you know, certifications. They have to show certain degrees and whatever, like any other school does. So far, yes. So far we have been very lucky with all our 80 teachers, and he's seen it. I mean, it's not a whole community that is living and we are pulling 80 out of that. No. It's all those people coming in from the outside world. Somehow Mother has blessed us with a unique environment. If we allow that environment to operate subconsciously, unconsciously within us, by and large, the overall, you know, strata lifts. You know, there's a lifting of the consciousness, if you will. That's the only way I can explain it. Tea is getting cold.